The Sovereign Lord has given me an instructed tongue, to know the word that sustains the weary. He wakens me morning by morning, wakens my ear to listen like one being taught. The Sovereign Lord has opened my ears, and I have not been rebellious. I have not drawn back. I offered my back to those who beat me, my cheeks to those who pulled out my beard. I did not hide my face from mocking and spitting. Because the Sovereign Lord helps me, I will not be disgraced. Therefore have I set my face like flint, and I know I will not be put to shame. He who vindicates me is near. Who then will bring charges against me? Let us face each other. Who is my accuser? Let him confront me. It is the Sovereign Lord who helps me. Who is he that will condemn me? This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
It is taken from Luke chapter 19, verses 28 to 40, and can be found on page 1054 of the Pew Bibles. Hear the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Luke. Glory to you, O Lord. And when he had said these things, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. When he drew near to Bethpage and Bethany, at the mount that is called Olivet, he sent two of the disciples, saying, "Go into the village in front of you, where on entering you will find a colt tied, on which no one has ever yet sat. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, 'Why are you untying it?' you shall say this, 'The Lord has need of it.' So those who were sent away and found it, just as he has told them. And as they were untying the colt, its owners said to them, 'Why are you untying the colt?' And they said, 'The Lord has need of it.' And they brought it to Jesus, and throwing their cloaks on the colt, they set Jesus on it. And as he rode along, they spread their cloaks on the road. As he was drawing near, already on the way down the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of his disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works that they had seen, saying, 'Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest.' And some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to him, 'Teacher, rebuke your disciples.' He answered, 'I tell you, if these were silent, the very stones would cry out.' This is the gospel of the Lord. Praise to you, O Christ." Please do be seated. My attention was taken this week by an article which popped up on my iPad, as they do. It was taken from last week's Telegraph, and the heading was, "Men and Women Sin Differently According to Vatican Study." And there was little in the way of detail, but the gist of the report was that for women, pride is the most common sin committed, whereas it ranks only 5 for you guys. This observation immediately caught my attention, and it reminded me of something I'd read in this book. It's a Year with C.S. Lewis, and it has a reading from his classic works for every day of the year. And around this time of year, he has a lot to say about pride. And I wonder how many of us here today, both men and women, would admit to battling with the sin of pride. Lewis calls it the essential vice and utmost evil. Unchastity, anger, greed, drunkenness, and all that, he says, are mere flea bites in comparison. It was through pride that the devil became the devil. Pride leads to every other vice. It is the complete anti-God state of mind. And the problem with pride, he says, is that it always means enmity. Enmity between man and man, and between man and God. And he maintains crucially that as long as you are proud, you cannot know God. A proud man is always looking down on things and people. And of course, as long as you are looking down, you cannot see something that is above you. And today, Palm Sunday is the appropriate day to think about our pride, for it is the day when the humility of Christ was seen. And my big idea for today is this, that we must be prepared to walk with Jesus the way of the cross. We must be prepared to walk with Jesus the way of the cross. Now take a look at this slide and this arch. Does anyone recognise it? No, nearly, but not quite. I don't know where that one is. This is the Arch of Constantine, which is in Rome, and it stands beside the Colosseum. It was erected in 315 AD to celebrate a victory that Constantine had succeeded in battle. And one look at this arch conjures up a picture of what a victory procession would look like in those days. The victor in battle would ride into the city, dressed in special regalia, carried in a four-course carriage with his army, his captives, and the spoils of war following on behind. The victory procession was an impressive sight. But as Jesus approaches Jerusalem, the scene is very different. He comes into Jerusalem not on a stallion, a war horse, or in a chariot, but on a donkey, on a colt. And those in his procession do not wave their spears, but palm branches. And the monument to his victory, erected a week later, was not an ornately carved stone arch, but a roughly hewn wooden cross. And humility is seen in every aspect of Jesus' life. Jesus, the pre-existent Son of God, the creator of the universe who flung stars into space, set aside his glory and power and became man so that our relationship with God might be restored. When he was born, there was no room for him at the inn, and he was laid in a wooden manger, just as he died on a wooden cross. He was betrayed by Judas for the price of 30 silver coins, the value in Exodus of the life of a slave. And perhaps we see his humility most clearly through John's account of the Last Supper, when he washes the disciples' feet. People in those days wore open-toed sandals and the roads were very dusty. And so it was customary before they ate for the guests' feet to be washed. And this was considered in those days a very demeaning act. It was reserved for female slaves, the lowest of the low. Rich households would often have a slave whose duty it was to wash guests' feet. If there were no such slave, then the guests would be given water and a towel and they'd wash their own feet. But so demeaning was this task considered to be that if an Israelite had fallen into hard times and been taken into slavery, he or she could not be compelled to wash another's feet. But Jesus wasn't compelled to do any of this. He did it voluntarily. In humility, he gave up everything he had. He willingly lowered himself in his birth, in his ministry, and in his death. And no one took his life from him. He freely laid it down. Others did not have the chance to humble him because he humbled himself, even to death on a cross. And this is reflected in the words of the first reading we had from Isaiah this morning. This passage is one of four known as the suffering servant passages. And whilst the events that they refer to might originally have referred to events in the life of the prophet, they also reflect the service, the exaltation, and the suffering of Jesus through his death and resurrection. And here, thinking about Jesus' humility and his resolve, we read, "Therefore have I set my face like flint, and I know I will not be put to shame." So despite knowing the agony that was awaiting him, Jesus has a steadfast determination to obey God and follow his way. His face is set as hard as flint, and nothing will turn him aside. He could see all that lay ahead, but he willingly walked towards the cross and all it involved. Now, Roman citizens were often executed by beheading. It was the quick, dignified way to execute someone of any standing. Instead, Jesus was given punishments reserved only for slaves and rebels, flagellation and crucifixion. And these two penalties are not just about the pain, they are about the humiliation. In first century Palestine, men and women usually covered themselves, even in the heat, from head to toe. A crucified man was stripped naked for all to see. And the humiliation that Jesus endured is also seen in that Isaiah passage. "I offered my back to those who beat me, my cheeks to those who pulled out my beard. I did not hide my face from mocking and spitting." The act of beating someone in public is designed to confer power and status on the one doing the beating, to make them feel wholly superior to the person being beaten, who is left bent double in pain and broken. Similarly, pulling out a man's beard, although that's not referred to in our gospel passages, is meant to shame a man in a culture where masculinity is associated with honour and femininity with dishonour. So to pull out a man's beard, a sign of his masculinity, was meant to shame and ridicule him. And all of this is why today is not only called Palm Sunday, it's also called Passion Sunday, reflecting the suffering that Jesus, the servant Messiah, endured for us. Palm Sunday, in contrast, tells of Jesus as the Messiah. Jesus would by now have been well known to all the crowds that are pouring into Jerusalem for the Passover. And Passover at the time was undoubtedly the most political and the most volatile of all the festivals. It was a time when the people brought to mind the liberation of the Hebrews from Egypt, the blood of the lamb on the doorposts, the parting of the Red Sea, the giving of the Ten Commandments, the wandering in the wilderness, and the eventual movement into Canaan. And all this at a time when they are being dominated by another superpower, Rome. So in going to Jerusalem at the time of Passover, Jesus is placing himself in a dangerous situation. And as he rides down on the donkey on the side of the Mount of Olives, across the Kidron Valley and up to the gate in Jerusalem, he is welcomed by crowds who are looking for a king to rescue them from Roman rule, just as Moses had done before. And the crowds waving their palm branches would have recognized this as a fulfillment of the prophecy in Zechariah, chapter 9 and verse 9. "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." as Tom Wright puts it, it's a kind of instant royal celebration as they spread their cloaks on the road and welcome him as their king. The shouts of the crowd of disciples also reveals that they recognized him as Messiah, as they called out, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord." And this is taken from Psalm 118, which was used as a hymn of praise and sung at all the major festivals. So Palm Sunday story tells us of Jesus' messiahship and his divinity, and the Passion account reveals his suffering and his humanity. But the celebrations of Palm Sunday so quickly turn to the pain of the Passion. The cries of praise all too quickly become "Crucify him." Jerusalem at the time, as we've said, was an occupied city. They were living under Roman rule. And whilst the people may indeed have welcomed Jesus, they had their own agenda. Their welcome and praise was conditional upon him living up to the expectations that he would liberate them from Roman rule. And he knew all this. He knew what he was facing, and he knew what the future held for the city and how the nation would suffer for choosing to ignore the moment when God came down to them. And he's broken. Just a few verses on, he cries in anguish over the city of Jerusalem. "They will dash you to the ground, and you and your children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another, because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you." And of course, between AD 66 and AD 70, all he said came true. They did not recognize him. They did not see who he is. And in the days that followed, one after another, the crowds, the chief priests, Pilate, the Roman soldiers, and the bandits all say things that reveal exactly who Jesus is, but they do so in mockery. They call him the Messiah, the King of the Jews, God's Son, and King of Israel. And of course, he is all of these, but they do not recognize him. And what about those who did at least have some understanding of who he is? His disciples. Even though their understanding does seem to be a bit superficial, they know Jesus as their friend and leader. They've witnessed his ministry this past 3 years. But yet, in a word, they betray him. Judas betrays him to the authorities with a kiss. The disciples betray him by falling asleep in the garden when he'd asked them to keep watch with him, to pray with him. And Peter betrays him. 3 times he denies even knowing him. One question we might ask now is, where do we see ourselves in this story? We have the advantage of 2,000 years of hindsight, and it's easy to judge the characters in this story from a distance. But are we really so very different from them? How quickly does our faith falter when God does not deliver what we are expecting? How quickly do we turn aside when we realize the great cost and risks of following Jesus? How often do our self-serving instincts lead us to deny Jesus and his claim on our lives? So today we celebrate Palm Sunday, a happy, joyous occasion marked with celebration. And next Sunday too is a happy occasion, Easter Sunday, when we celebrate Jesus' victory over death and his resurrection. But therein lies the danger, especially in a world like today's, where for many, Holy Week, including Maundy Thursday and Good Friday, is a normal working week. Unless we make a conscious effort not to do so, it's all too easy to go from one celebratory Sunday to the next without considering what comes in between. The Passion. Palm Sunday, Maundy Thursday, Good Friday, and Easter Day are all part of the same story. To get the whole picture, we need to see them all. I'd urge you, if you're able then, to come along on Thursday night, come along on Friday, hear the story, experience the story of our redemption, and be changed by it. Hear the story of Jesus Christ, who, being in the very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on the cross. You see, there was no other way. Jesus is sometimes called the second Adam, and he had to undo the damage caused by the first. And what was the sin of our first parents? They disobeyed because they wanted to know what God knew, to be like God, to exalt themselves over God. They'd been bitten by the serpent and injected with the deadly venom of pride. And the antidote, the antivenom, could only be humility. The foot washing, donkey riding new Adam would crush the head of the deadly serpent by means of loving, humble obedience. And God responded to his humility by exalting him far above Caesars and kings and even Hollywood A-listers. And he invites us to share his glory with him. But first, as today's big idea demands, we must walk on his road to glory, the road of the cross. And I'll close with some thoughts from Tom Wright for us to reflect on. As we arrive at Jerusalem with Jesus, the question presses upon us. Are we going along for the trip in the hope that Jesus will fulfill some of our hopes and desires? Are we ready to sing a song of praise, but only as long as Jesus seems to be doing what we want? The long and dusty pilgrim way of our lives gives most of us plenty of time to sort out our motives for following Jesus in the first place. Are we ready not only to spread our cloaks on the road in front of him, to do the showy and flamboyant thing, but also now to follow him into trouble, controversy, trial, and death? Thank you. Thank you.